Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Nicole Demers, and I'm a screenwriter who has written for many shows in the youth space. So I'm really excited to talk to today's guest, Frank Van Keeken, showrunner of the popular TV show The Next Step. The Next Step is about an elite group of young dancers who train at the Next Step Dance Studio. It's scripted, but also relies on the improv skills of the young dancers who star in the show. Naturally, part of our conversation is about the role of the writer on a reality-based drama like The Next Step. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Well, thanks for coming out and talking to us tonight, Frank. It's really nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So maybe we can start a little bit before we talk about what we just saw. I mean, I always find it really interesting as a writer to hear a person's history and sort of how they got into the business. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got your first job writing TV and your second and third. Some writers say that's even harder to get than your first.
The first sitcom?
Yeah, the first job that you got a written by credit on.
There was a show, there's a stand-up, Pat Bullard. He lived out of Toronto. His brother Mike Bullard ended up having that talk show. And Mike came to it after, we're actually doing Mike's biography. Mike came to it after Pat doing stand-up. Pat was this incredibly good-looking guy. He had like no act, but he was so gorgeous, no one cared. He had like two jokes that he could stretch to a half an hour. It was just insane. He had the tightest ass, and he wore these tight jeans and this white shirt. And just it just like, I fell in love with him. He was just so gorgeous. He ended up getting a talk show out in British Columbia. Like, it was a provincial show. And I ended up writing some sketches on the show. And then there was some puppet on the show, and he swore at the puppet, "Can we bleep this? Is this bleepable? I don't want this to go." But he told a puppet to... on CBC, and they just canceled the show. It was gone. Like, and it was doing pretty well. And I wrote a few I can't remember what they were, but I wrote a few sketches for that.
And then, how did you move into sitcoms and scripted comedy?
Well, I had always had a predilection to sitcom. I mean, I just love it.
Didn't you start? Correct me if I'm wrong. As a stand-up comedian, did you do some stand-up?
Stand-up and improvisation, okay. And from there you sort of graduate to sketch, and then from there to longer form stuff. Mm-hmm. I know what my first sort of sitcom gig was. I had a development deal when Paul Chatto was head of comedy at the CBC. It was Yvonne Fitzon, and they started to do sitcom again. And they did Material World, In Opposition, and Mosquito Lake. And they were all doing really well, but the reviewers, the critics, panned them. And then they just canceled doing sitcom in the country.
Sort of like now.
That's what happened. They just stopped doing sitcom. They didn't say, well, these shows didn't work, let's change them. They just, no, we're not doing sitcom anymore. And I, in there, got a development deal to do a show. It was about a guy. He was like this English major that had left this northern, like Northwest Territory town and gone away and then couldn't get work, had come back, and he was running the bookmobile. Driving around, and his dad, like, it was like Northern Exposure owned everything. And his dad hated him because he was sort of wussy and city-fied. And there was some professional football player who had committed a murder or something, was hiding out there from the NFL. And his sister, I can't remember, it's just sort of this milieu of somewhere. But we got to fly with, we got to fly to Atlin Lake, which is either Northwest Territories or in British Columbia, to meet some outfitters and trappers and people that lived like in this northern town. And I was up there for 3 days with my writing partner at the time, Gary Jones was his name. He and I and my other daughter, who was three at the time, we flew up there. And we were there for like 4 or 5 days. And we flew back, and then we wrote this pilot. And then Paul Chatto, I think he either hated it or sitcom had ended. I can't, somewhere in there. And then that was the end of that. But that was sort of the first sitcom gig somewhere late 80s, I think.
And then you went on to write for, like, Kids in the Hall and one of the most, I mean, I was checking out your IMDb page, and they're not always the most accurate, but you did Kids in the Hall, and then...
I'm the Pete Best of the Kids in the Hall. I am. I left the troupe about a year or two. There's a couple of us that are Pete Bests, actually. Gary Campbell is another one. Norm Hiscock, who wrote for them, was sort of also one. And there's a very early one, Bill Gemmel, was in a group called The Audience, that were precursors to the Kids in the Hall. And we all left because it was just endless infighting. They were like, we literally got into fist fights over sketches. Like, that's how stupid we were. And I was like getting more and more enthralled with stand-up. So I wanted to explore that. And so I went off to start just doing stand-up. Because I had this big sort of anxiety at the time that I really wasn't funny. And I was just being carried by the rest of the troupe. So I thought, well, I'll go out and do stand-up. And it might have been true, because I suffered for a long time as a stand-up.
I think every writer probably questions that many times in their life. And is that how you made your transition to going down to the States and writing there, through stand-up comedy?
No, I moved out to Vancouver. I had sort of quasi-fallen in love and moved out to Vancouver. It's almost, other than I have two children, older children out of it, I think the only real regret I have is that I moved there instead of going to the States. This is sort of the mid, and this is prior to writing for the Kids in the Hall, because I went out to Vancouver and I was there for 4 or 5 years, and then moved back to Toronto and got hired as a writer on the Kids in the Hall. And when I first moved back, Mark McKinney had some kind of government housing thing on College, and he let me and my ex-wife and daughter stay there until we sort of found our footing, as it were. And then I wrote for them for a year.
And then how did you get your first, because, you know, obviously Mad About You was probably a very exciting time in your life, and I noticed you penned an episode of Seinfeld.
No, I was an actor.
You were an actor in Seinfeld. Yes. Oh, okay, my mistake. Yeah. But anyway, talk a little bit about what you learned from writing sitcom in the United States.
I would say that a lot of this stuff, the power of the room, is more than anything one of the glorious things that have come out of my time there. It's a very, you know, the writer is king there, and the writer is the head, the apex predator in the room, on the show, for that matter. Everything serves that vision. Whether, even if it's a wrong vision, the homogeneity of that is better than art by committee. And I've taken that sometimes much to studio and network chagrin to heart. And I fiercely defend the vision of a show.
And how did you, I mean, you kind of came back from, I guess, working in sitcom in LA and moved back to Canada. And how did you find yourself sort of, did you have a great desire to write for youth television? Did you want stories you wanted to tell because of your kids?
No, I completely fell into it. I'd moved back, and I think I'd sort of climbed high enough up the mountain there that I didn't necessarily need to climb any higher. Although I'd sold a bunch of pilots that I got to write and didn't get to make. I had gone out to Vancouver and done a show called Big Sound, and I did a season on that, and I was like fired halfway through. It was an utter catastrophe for me, although I learned a lot of lessons in that process. And had decided for various and sundry reasons to kind of come back to Canada. And while I was there, my agent in L.A. said, well, and I was working on Billable Hours, was a show that I was hired to EP, and I EP'd the second and third season. But during that time, or even prior to actually officially starting that show, my agent in LA had said that Disney was looking for a show. And I had this notion at the time, it was called Angel on Campus, that later became Winging It. And I started to develop that telephonically, because I had moved for some reason to Stratford, and I'd never lived there before. I didn't know the town. We just sort of picked it off of a map and moved there. And had developed it through email and telephonically with the people at Disney, and they were now ready to purchase a script. Like, I kind of outlined it and done all that stuff you have to do. And then it came time to negotiate my fee, and it was so ludicrously low that I had the balls to go, no, you're not going
to
get this.
Welcome to writing for youth TV.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. I think that was that case, and I stuck up for myself at least to say, no, I'd rather work in a Starbucks, quite honestly, than be paid that to run a show. And so I just kind of chucked it in a drawer. And then the folks at Temple Street, Dave Forte and Ivan Schneeberg, during the course of making Billable Hours, said, do you have anything? And I said, well, actually, I've got this pitch that's already been Disney-proofed. Like, they already like it. And so we took that over to Family Channel, and it kind of moved up the food chain really easily, although it did take a long time. It took about 2 years by the time, from when I pitched it to when it got on the air. And then I ended up doing, I think we did 53 seasons, 51 episodes of that.
And just to backtrack, you said something really interesting that kind of segues into my next question. You got fired from Big Sound, and it was a complete disaster. And
I've been fired from several television shows. Well, and at the time, it's really painful. It really hurts.
I think it's really good for, you know, any aspiring writers out there, any mid-level writers. You know, you're going to get fired from something at some point. I mean, it's such.
I was fired from The Kids in the Hall.
Okay.
I'm not joking.
Like, what do you know now that you wish you knew then? Like, is there any advice you can give to?
No, there is no advice. People think there is. You're walking around in the wilderness by yourself with these notions that you have some, you know, artistic bent, that you have something to say, that you want to write whatever, and you just keep plodding along. And if you're good enough or find a way to get good enough, you might be successful. Oh, happy times. That's sort of all there's really there. And if it's kind of, it's not like you make your own opportunity, but you have to open yourself up. I mean, there were many times everywhere where I remember standing at a window looking out going, what am I supposed to do? Like, when I first moved to LA, I was at the point where I had split up with my first wife. I was living there. Living off the avails of my girlfriend at the time, like, I literally had to borrow money. Say, can I borrow $10 to get, like, a coffee today? And she so resented it, right? Like, it was horrendous. And she was like, why don't you get a job? And I said, well, I can't go out and audition if I'm, you know, working, like, at a... So it was like this sort of, like, please support me because I do think I'm going to make it. And I eventually did enough. Like, I started writing on Mad About You and started working, and I ended up, like, paying her back.
I forget who said it, but someone actually made a comment about that a writer's life is kind of built on the foundation of all the people who have supported them over the years. So,
yeah, there's a great George Orwell story, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, that you should all read if you want to understand the writer's lot. I mean, it's excessively bleak. And it so resonated. Well, I read that before I even started writing. And it resonated.
On that note, I think one of your daughters, your older daughter, Chloe, is a writer on The Next Step,
yeah.
If I'm right. So, I mean, what do you... I'm a first-generation writer. I knew no one in the business, had no sort of buddy I could lean on. What do you tell her when she comes to you and she says, Dad, I want to write, you know, and I'm choosing this as my life. And, you know, did you have any advice for her?
I don't care what she does. I mean, as long as she's happy... My son, winging it, he ended up being this character, Serge Del Vecchio. He played Serge, this big meat-heady guy, and he did a great job. And then he spent all of his money. He made enough that he could have bought a condo. And now he's living with his mom, and he's working in a coffee shop. And even today, he texted me, Dad, you got to get me out of this hourly, like, horror. And I'm like, no, you're going to figure it out, right? And he could be a good actor. He's funny, and he's good-looking, and... I don't care. I'm there to support in a way. Francesca has quite a predilection to performance, right? That kid just oozes performance, and I'm there to support it, and I'm there to support anything that they want to do to a degree without enabling. I used to get asked all the time when I was a stand-up. People would say, oh, Frank, how do I become a stand-up? And I'd say, oh, I'll tell you. I'll tell you, this is how you do it. I want you to this, first do this. Go out and do 500 shows and then come back and then I'll tell you. And then you, by the time you do 500 shows, you go, well, I don't do those jokes when I'm in Barrie because they won't work, right? And I can do these jokes here or whatever. You just kind of, you figure it out. It's just not, it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, it's true. I think someone described it best as you become a writer when you don't want to do anything else, you know?
Well, you're not suited to do anything else, right? Like, what else can I do? Like, I, when I came back to Canada, I remember going, maybe I'm not even going to be in show business. And I remember applying to the Stratford newspaper to be the agricultural reporter. Because I have strong science base background. Like,
did you do a degree, a university degree? In...
Well, I've listened to a lot of podcasts. And I Google lots of stuff. But I have a facility for that. And I could easily have done that. I was fascinated by those sorts of things. I couldn't get arrested. Like, what's a, like, executive producer, supervising producer? Like, that means nothing to them. Like, and I tried to tone it up, like, in charge of 100 people. Like, does that make sense? So I couldn't even get arrested. So I'm not suited to do anything else. So it's not like I would enjoy anything else in my life, but I hate this least.
On that note, change gears a little. I'd love to talk about the inception of The Next Step, because for anyone who wants to write for tween and teen television, and you're not watching Disney and Nickelodeon and in Canada, Family Channel and YTV, probably should be. But you see a lot of, you know, traditional four-camera sitcoms, you know, bright colors, laugh track, cram as many jokes on the page as you can, usually high concept. And this is so different than that. How did you convince a network to sort of go away from the norm or the tried, tested, and proven model and do something so different?
Well, I'll tell you.
Okay. Please do.
And so a couple of things. One is I didn't want to, after winging it, engaging in 2 years of development, go through that again. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to shoot a pilot. And this was this was after I had the idea. And the idea just came to me. I was actually literally driving to the Walmart in Hanover. I was on my way to Hanover across Highway 4, and it just, the whole show came to me. Almost all of it. Just like, wow. And I literally pulled over, and I called up. Either I couldn't get Dave or Ivan on the phone, and I said, I have this idea. But it's so low concept, I can't pitch it. Because what's the concept of the show? A bunch of dancers decide to compete. That's really the show.
And often low concept shows don't. They do great on TV.
That smokes and stuff like that. To add that, or, you know, can it be done in outer space? Like, they're always wanting to do something to the show. So I managed to convince them to give me a little bit of money to shoot a pilot. And then Michael Goldsmith, he got wind of this and said, oh, I'm going to fund it. And it was done for about $30,000.
And Michael Goldsmith is the head of Family Channel.
Family Channel. And it was his great wisdom to just take a flyer on it. And really, that's the amount of development that you would get for, what, 3 scripts and a Bible? And I thought, well, I'm going to shoot a whole pilot. And I cast dancers. And this is sort of, okay, I mean, if you want to get into kind of deconstructing what I think might make a successful show, is there has to be some semblance of believability to the concept. So all of these dancers are insanely good. And what do? They just legitimize the world. They say, this is really a dance world. Therefore, I believe that world. Therefore, I believe the stories that come out of that world. On the Facebook page, no one ever asks, was that Fuate wasn't good. They're asking about Jiley. They're asking about some relationship. They're asking, why is Amanda so mean? Like, that's what they care about. Well, that's all embedded inside of this reality that I've created, or the team of us that have created this show, that makes everything else believable. I hired dancers, and I taught them to act. And now you look at Chloe, right, who first started very textual. She's very smart, but all of her reads originally were very textual, and it took a while to get her to kind of get into her body and start producing, as the kids say, the feels. Right now she's a feel machine, right? The feels just pour out of her.
That was actually one of my questions, because I was going to ask if you looked for actors who knew how to dance.
No.
Okay. You just went for dancers first and foremost.
Can you dance? Mm-hmm. Can you perform? And a lot of them can, because they perform. And do you have TVQ, right? There's some people, phenomenal dancers, but when they're on camera, they don't read. So once you have those three things, and I could put together this kind of group of people, then we just worked. And it was tedious at first to figure out, like, I remember the first episode I edited was episode 7 of season 1, which I also did actually on this new show we're going to show a clip on. And I had to reshoot about 5 scenes, like endlessly, like, why isn't this working? It took me a long time to figure it out. And the performances were rough.
Did you have the luxury or the budget or the time to sort of do a lot of workshopping with them before? Or was
no.
it all on the
why?
Fly?
I'm not big on workshops. I remember writing on billable hours, and the writing room was sort of like a little bit in turmoil, and they wanted to kind of like understand the characters. And we'd already, like, there was already a season of TV there. And I was like, oh, I got to do this stupid exercise. All right, I want to do this exercise. And I was like, okay. I had to try to act all like official and stuff. Make a list of all of like 3 questions you'd like to ask each character. Well, everyone got all excited, right? There's like charts and stuff like that. And then I said, okay, now everyone go away for an hour and you answer all those questions. And then come back and we'll compare. And they went off and I went and had coffee, which made me very happy because I didn't want to do that stupid exercise. And everyone came back and then we compared. And like 90% of the answers were the same. They already knew. So I said, see, you know, done, boom, let's start writing episodes. So I don't know what you're going to gain out of a workshop. I mean, Chloe is Chloe, right? She's going to give you what she gives you, this act, the character, coming out of the actress.
But I'm having a little bit of a panic attack on your behalf. So it's season 1, episode 1.
Yeah.
You're going to camera.
Yeah.
You got 15 dancers, 12 dancers?
Yeah, somewhere on there.
Okay, and none of them can act.
Well, no.
I mean, sorry,
none of them
not to be reductive.
Traditionally act. I
Fair
mean,
enough.
One of them just got nominated for a CSA last year. Like, and here's another little thing, too. Like, I remember we did these auditions. We auditioned 500-600 dancers. And 50 would come into the ballet at a time. And I did a kind of, like, scan. I was like $6 million man. I was like, and I was kind of scanning all these people. And Brittany Raymond, who plays Riley, was in the back, and I was like, I just like zoomed in, and I was like, please be a good dancer. Please be a good dancer. And she danced well, right? And I said, okay, now please be able to talk. Please be able to talk. And she could, right? Already, right away. Right away, brilliant.
So you kind of credit your years in TV with being able to sort of use that Terminator vision to find the talent, and, you know, because obviously there was a learning curve. I can imagine.
I do have some facility for casting, but I think really the art of it is to construct an environment on set where people are okay to experiment and okay to fail. Like, we don't write scripts. We write outlines. I don't write dialogue anymore. Like, it's almost ugly to have to write the words, because the words, they like, all that's up there. I mean, occasionally we help them out with some of the dialogue. That's mostly them writing, like saying stuff the way they would. I can't write the things they say. Very few of us can. It's just so brilliant and in the moment. So, I guess if you just create an environment where they can fail and know it's okay, like we'll cut out the bad bits, then people start just trying stuff.
That actually opens up a really interesting line of questioning, because I think we're so used to typically scripted programming, and obviously Winging It was one of those. And for anyone in the audience who doesn't know what a typically scripted program would look like, a writer would come to you with a premise, you would approve it, the network would approve it, the production company might have a say, and then they would go write an outline.
Well, no, we, again, I do things a little differently, and I'm a big proponent of the room. The room is everything. It is this massive, powerful beast, and I honor it. Like, it is the safest place for me to be in the universe. Or, like, in my old days after a stand-up show, to be in Meyer's Deli and listening to stand-ups talking about some gig where it was hell for them, whatever their stories were. The writing room is powerful, so we room write everything. In big rooms, you can afford to send someone off, but I find the work inferior. My work was always inferior. I would, to be off by myself for a week and a half to do what the room can do in half a day is why.
And I guess, I mean, just back to, you know, whether you write in your style or you, you know, typically write, but a room would write an outline and then a first draft and then a second draft.
Yes, but a room can do that. A sitcom, we can write a sitcom with dialogue with a half decent bunch of writers, 4 hours. If we've got an outline, we can put a draft out. And then we can spend the half of a day putting it together and one more day and you could shoot it. 2 days, beautiful draft. Because you've got 10 brains working on it. And mostly what they're doing is weeding out the stuff you think is good, right? You're sitting there, you know, at 3 o'clock, well, that's funny. And you start typing that in, and you know, you bring it to the room, and they're going like, what was he? Like, that's stupid, right? Like, you weed out a lot of bad stuff. There's, like, you know, there's nothing better than the bright minds of a writing room. It's heaven.
But, you know, talk a little bit about how the next step differs from that traditional sort of sense. You guys, you don't do drafts? You're saying
well,
you don't
all the
do
work is in the outline.
Okay.
The words, like I said, they're so quick to write. You can write the jokes. If the better the story, the easier the joke is to write. So it's all the work is days sometimes, banging away at some stupid outline and making it work and throwing this A story out or this B story or... Once you get the story, and there's some stories you just, it's going to work. Others, I even have to shoot, and I go, we'll see. Might have to, you know, try and fix that later in post or whatever we try and do. But it's in the outline. If the outline works, everything is going to be good.
I mean, that would be my next question to you. I mean, as a writer, the outline is king. I think anybody who's an experienced writer grows to love the outline. You do most of your work there, and if you get it right, your drafting is a breeze. It's wonderful. And the fun of going to draft is dialogue. I mean, that's where you get to make jokes, and sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad, but you get to play and you get to, you know, play with these characters, and that's the fun. Like, you do all this heavy lifting to get to the point that you can have fun at draft stage. Do you miss that?
No.
Right?
I'm not sure exactly why. I think maybe I'm just tired of my jokes. Like, they're doing better stuff, and the room does better stuff. And in the moment of it, when we shoot the show, it's very organic. Like, I sit at the monitors, and it's literally like this. It's called the voice of God. It's a mic that the actors can hear on set. And so we just stop. I'll go freeze. All right, talk about the fact that you're angry about the fact that she's going to take that dance position and be a little more ferocious. And they just start talking and they do the scene. Okay, I think trying to use the word sesquicentennial, they'll just throw it in. And if it doesn't work, we cut it out. But it's very in the moment. And that's, for me, much more interesting. I don't know. I think there's, not to, like, I don't want to insult you, but I find there's a preciousness to that joke. You know, when you're on the floor in a room in L.A. on show night, which is one of my also second, like my maybe second favorite moment in existence, is to be on the floor on show night, Friday night, and there's an audience there. Well, after the scene that has had so many drafts and room passes and the actors working on it, and Friday night, and they're doing it, as soon as it's like cut, there's 10 writers that swarm the EP with joke pitches, trying to fix what we thought was brilliant. And it's all, you know, you're just fighting the whole time, trying to make it work all the time, till, okay, we're moving on. And so I think if you can get away with this notion that anything you write is good or great or fun, it's just part of the process. I think it liberates you a little bit. If that might be a way to maybe.
Yeah, yeah, no,
that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what these things are so good to
Does that
to
sound
hear.
Weird, what I just no, said.
To hear different processes and things that work for different writers. I mean, I guess that leads to another question of what kind of showrunner you are. I mean, in order to do what you say, there's some showrunners who say, you know, I love being in the writing room. That's my primary place, and I will go to set when necessary. And then you seem to be the kind of showrunner who lives on set and is there for every frame.
I don't think a frame of film should be shot that the showrunner doesn't see. They won't roll without me. If I go 10-1 and I don't tell them, like there's people running around because they know nothing will get shot.
Especially if you're the voice of God.
Well, regardless of that, someone else can get on that and I'd be happy for that. But I have to see everything because I'm also there cutting it. And they all go, no, we have a two shot where the line reading was better. That was shot, whatever, even 6 months ago. My facility to recall that is sort of diminishing over time, but I see that. I love being in the writing room, but I end up having to leave it, and then they forget me. Like, it's like I come in, and you can see they're like, who's that guy? Like, they've made strange. It's odd, you know? But that's part of that process.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about your writing room and how you set it up? And I'm assuming from what you said about only going to outline and not drafting, maybe you were looking for different writers, in a typical writing room for comedy, you'd look for people who are really good at story, people who are really funny, could write great dialogue. Hopefully that's the same writer, but not always. Did you set up your writing room for...
I like a bunch of different voices. So like in my current room... There are, I think, better joke people. There's some people that are better story people. There's some people that are better with emotionality. There's a kind of, some have, the Venn diagram of those things. There's more intersection. It's just a kind of a varied sound. There's different sort of femininities and masculinities and education levels. It's just this, I like a variety, a bunch of people there. The biggest thing, you got to be bright. I mean, they're smart people. Really smart people. And so when you're sitting there attacking a problem, you're analyzing it in a way where you go, well, those same people could solve, UN issues. Like they wouldn't, or how to get water from that village over there. I mean, they're smart people. They would just sort of, okay, well, should we do a trench? And they start pitching on the trench. Well, who's going to do the shovels? And they figure it out. They're bright people. You want bright people.
In that vein, do you encourage your writers? Like, did you, going back a little, did you have a showrunner? I think one of the things in this country that we're starting to get better at, the showrunner model is very American, and in this country we didn't tend to have showrunners until, they're sort of taking the fore the last 8 to 10 years, and the creative showrunner, writer-producer. Did you have a showrunner that really taught you the ropes and, like, that you can credit with giving you the skills that you needed to, because it's a very different job than being a writer. I mean, it's a people manager. It's, it's a large corporation you're running.
I mean, you would sort of vicariously see the hell that they were in. I would see that and I go, why is he in that or she in that current hell? And I'd kind of ask questions. But often they're so lost to it. Like my writers, some see different parts of what I do, but a lot of them, I'm off, I'll be doing stuff they have no idea I'm necessarily doing, and they won't until they have to somehow do it. Although I try as much as possible to get everyone as dirty as possible because I just want as much support as I can. But it's a real trial by fire. You slowly kind of evolve your way through all of the gates and doors and things you've got to jump over, and you kind of finally... I'm still always surprised. I was like, I didn't know that. Like that's... daily, almost,
Do you encourage your writers to join you on set and in
editing? Everything. Yeah. I want them, they can come to editing, they can be on set, in my world, and I tell them this, they are the courtiers, the princes and princesses of the kingdom. They go wherever they want to go. I literally have a sign on my door, knock, unless you're Laurie McLarty, who's our producer. I want her to be able to go wherever she wants to go. But you knock on that door. You don't walk in there. You don't walk into the writing room. Who the hell do you think you are? there are gods in there. We're trying to change the world or this world or whatever we're working on. No, you genuflect. And I mean that. So they go wherever they want to go.
Do you just walk me through like a typical week in your writing room, like how you would sort of structure that?
It depends. It's a process. Like on Friday, I think it was Friday or Thursday, a room had pitched us like the second episode to season four of the next step that we're beginning to now write. Like we're sort of finishing up Lost and Found, this new show that I'm doing, and we're starting season four. So there's some crossover. And they came to the set to pitch me, and I was in a really bad mood. And I said, I don't think you should pitch me right now, because I think I'll just kill your pitch. And I felt really happy that I had that sort of self-awareness, because in the old days I would have just heard the pitch and I killed it, right? And then they didn't pitch. So that day, that didn't get pitched. And other days, we have other... I don't know. I'm not being helpful, am I? It's dynamic. We have a lot of work to do. There's all these episodes, and we start just talking about, like, season four of The Next Step. Actually, I haven't been as excited about a season of television for a long time, and a lot of it I didn't even figure out. Like, I came in the room, and the room had figured it out.
That's great.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I was like, holy cow, this is so good. Like, it just, and it rejuvenated everyone, because we've just finished almost 26 episodes of Lost and Found, and we've got 40 Next Steps coming up. We're doing 66 half hours in 6 months. Oh,
that's
massive.
You know, just back to the next step before we move on to the Lost and
Found. I should say, sorry to interrupt, but we break story. We sit there and talk about what's going to happen episode one and episode, maybe start overall, like this character can arc this way a little bit, and we just start filling it in and filling it in. It gets richer and richer, and then we start coming up with callbacks and notions and little bits and pieces that resonate, and it slowly develops this kind of tapestry of glory. You know, you just keep looking at it, and it's like this painting, and you're just, ooh, let's put another apostle in there. Right? How many have we got? 15. Ah, so what? They're all good. Let's have 15. All right, we'll paint one out. How many were? Whatever, you fill it in. Let's add a mustache. Oh, that didn't work. We're always trying stuff and making it rich and filling it out. And then that's somehow how you get there. And again, I've encouraged you in the writing room too. I'll rip them if I think they're saying something stupid. I really want, just not because I do get a little bit excited by being able to get excited about stuff, but it's mostly about let's figure it out. Like, why are you saying that? I'll challenge the writers. There's a bunch of them here. I'll challenge them on their assertions. And sometimes they change my mind, and I'm so happy, right? Then I know, well, I'm well represented, or I'm well taken care of, right? I don't know if that added.
Yeah, no. That one thing that I find really interesting about The Next Step is, you know, writing for teen television, you're often told, like, no large production numbers. Like, you know, the line producer would, it's just no. There's a no. The best you might get away with occasionally is...
Line producer answers to me. Everyone answers to me. So I've had bad line producers, but I got a great one now. And we talk about stuff. Lori McLarty is... a goddess. She's brilliant. And we have these discussions, and she say, if you do that, then that means that. Well, then what about that? Well, then that will mean that. Like, she keeps me informed. So we do workarounds. Like, we shot in the Sony Center last year. Who shoots in the Sony Center? We were there for 6 days. It's a big union house. We had to fill that up with 3,000 people. Right? Well, what did we do? We have fans. So we put 4-hour shifts of fans. We brought 9,000 fans in a day and a half, and we charged them $5 each. So they would show up. And that paid for all of the cost of the guy who got all the people to show up and manage all of that. And that saved me about $350,000. And then I got to go to Florida, and I got to shoot in the Everglades with 4 big airboats. That's what we did last year. Why? Because I was judicious with the money. So this I shoot in a day and a half an episode. Look at how many cuts. There's about 500 to 700 cuts in this episode. So I remember some editor showing up who was from like Rookie Blue, and they said they had 350 in an hour. right? That's a zippy piece of television. I'm running three cameras. We shoot massive amounts. Like first season, I shot 26 episodes. 26 episodes were ordered, and we delivered 30. We shot four extra episodes worth of content, and they bought them because they were good. So you have to be mindful. Like, you just can't go, I need the helicopter. Why? Get a guy on a ladder and then save some money and then put it where you need to, right? So it's about, again, and why? Because as a showrunner, I have to be responsible for that and make those decisions and not cede responsibility. Why would you cede any responsibility to anyone?
So you sort of... Oh, yeah, no. So you sort of...
got all excited there.
You do... simpler to produce episodes like the one we saw, and then you save.
What do you mean simple? There was CGI. I made someone beam away.
Fair enough. Notwithstanding the CGI, you save all your money for the. I believe it was season two, and it was Nationals.
Sure.
And you were shooting in the Sony Center in Mississauga.
Sony Center was downtown Internationals.
Living Arts Center.
Living Arts Center, which had about 700 BG, which we bought. We also bought some dummies from the States. They flew up, but they put the hats on. And the coats and stuff, but it turned out to be a disaster. Like at the end, there's this great shot where it's like standing ovation, and there's a dolly up in the balcony, and then there's this four like just heads with hair on them, and they don't move. Like everyone else is up, and there's this, like it was just a disaster.
But I mean, you shot like three large production numbers with costumes.
Oh, more than that.
That
was that episode. We shot last year something like 80 dances. We had... on our call sheet at Internationals last year, 140 actors on the call sheet. That's how many, that's at 100 and whatever, almost $200,000 on that day for actors. Because I save my money. I shoot these in a day and a half, and I'm judicious about it. And I have really smart people helping me, going, do this, and then you don't have to do that. But I'm in control of it. I try to understand it. I don't cede responsibility.
Did you learn any tricks to shooting these gigantic dance sequences?
Well, look at this episode. Okay, so let's look at the Talia Eldon story where he has to do all the pirouettes. So we've got him doing pirouettes with West. Talia comes in at the end of that and has a talk where she's on the floor and they get up. We've got Chloe and West talking. Right? There's like about four scenes all in one episode. I shot that in about a half an hour, all four of them, maybe an hour. Right? Because why waste time? I shoot with three cameras. I don't turn around. I try not to turnarounds. I'm just drilling it out. I'm just drilling out the pages, just shooting quantity, getting performance rather than like, I don't have time to like the camera dollies off of this and goes over there. And then I don't have time for that. So even today I was shooting, and we were shooting about five scenes in Java Junction, one of our sets. No one moved. Like every scene, you come in there and sit there, and you sit there. And no one knows. No one cares. If you're doing an hour procedural, maybe it would matter, right? But for a kid show, it's all bright and fast, and no one ever knows that nothing changes. So just be judicious. All right, was that the question? Did I answer that question?
Yeah, that's a great answer. I think we're going to take a quick break and watch a little clip from your new show, which is called Lost and Found Music Studios.
So, yes, let's do that. I want to say a couple of things. So, what is the next step about? It's about tribal affinity. That's the resonating undercurrent of that show. This whole episode 12 that we just saw was all about that, right? Do I belong? Should I leave the group? What should the group do for me? That whole series is just that. It's just that. Endlessly regurgitated. And that makes the show work. It has a theme that the kids can, even subconsciously, they get it, even if it consciously we're not necessarily stating it. And this is the new show, and its theme, although it might not be represented in the first, whatever, two or three minutes, is... your only hope for salvation is to be yourself. You have to find your voice to survive anything. And we will regurgitate that throughout the course of the series.
That's sort of the underpinning. Anyways, I don't know if that's sort of reflected. And this is from the demo pilot that we shot that we threw out. We shot this last September.
Oh, that's great. And just for podcast listeners, read a quick little blurb about what your show's about. Or did you want to? Yeah.
Sure.
It's from your office. Lost and Found Music Studios is a half-hour tween series following the lives of a group of musicians who are members of an after-school music program where they explore and discover their musical identities. Mr. T, the owner of Lost and Found Music Studios and an established music producer, admits a small number of new members each year to join the group and ends the year by selecting some of the standout members to participate in a live tour, which means that you're going on tour.
Well, I'm trying to develop an ecosystem that has, they call it, whatever, that 360, whatever. Like, this, like Next Step has a live tour, and they just had a movie in the theaters this last weekend, and they toured Canada, and there's books and T-shirts and key fobs and all kinds of stuff. That also came out of the original understanding of the show, like trying to do a show that has that capability. So Lost and Found, it used to be called The Music Room, but the name is now Lost and Found Music Studios. We've done 26 episodes, and we've shot 80 songs. We've wrote 80 singles. We have this great music department. And they're going to be, and we shot them all for video purposes, and they'll be out on iTunes. And that's all stuff that's sort of beyond my pay grade. I don't have to worry about it. But that was part of the construction of the show when I first began to think about it, to make it as potentially successful and as appetizing as possible to broadcasters or production companies or other stakeholders.
Do you get a piece of the merchandising?
I do.
if that's the really
show
smart.
If the show is successful. So a living can be made. You can make a really good living. And ironically, like, this is sort of sad, but like when I went to the States, I developed an American quote price. And when I came back to Canada, I was able to say, well, that's my price, and keep that going. And you can make a living. You have to stand up for yourself. It's hard, though, when you're schmucking around just trying to get into a room, right? It's really hard. But I don't even think you should think about Canada as like a place to write. It's a beta testing place. This is like, there's the whole world we can write to now, especially with the Netflixes and the Hulus and the Showmes and whatever. Like, it's all out there now potentially for us. Anyway, I'm waxing stupid.
No, that's it's very interesting. So let's throw to that little clip.
Sit here and
yeah.
Crouch down. Can you see the screen?
Get down. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, obviously that was a genius segue with your Next Step dancers and, you know, sort of introducing the music room and, or sorry, rather the Lost and Found Music Studios. How did this show come about?
It was actually the network. I'm not 100% sure of the history, but I think Paul Cormack, who's a communications guy, marketing guy at Family Channel, thought, well, because I'd created this set. I wanted a different world. So I thought, well, there'd be some music school somewhere in this place that I imagine sort of like 401 Richmond that had all these, you know, there's like a, you can get, you know, clothing there, and there's psychiatrist offices on one floor and a photography thing and this music school, this music studio place. And so I built this music room set, and he said, well, it would be really cool, either him or Michael Goldsmith, who said, to do this as a show. And I just then took that and developed it into this.
Well, I, as a former preteen girl, you know, cute boy singing is always going to get you a really good audience. So,
and there's cute girls, and here's the other thing too. I just hired singers. These are all great, insanely good voices. Just they're amazing. And yeah, I think there's a, you know, yeah, I agree.
Can you talk a little bit about how you, you know, you said you cast great musicians. Do you spend a lot of time on creating characters, like, you know, backstories, that whole?
No.
No?
You just cast who you think is it and make them do the job. And the better actor, the more facility in terms of where they can go, latitude, right? But you just make sure you get that sound, not to
I don't know what the term is to be too punning in relationship to this, but every character has a kind of a vibe to them that you get. Even out of these two cameras, you get a sense of who they are. Well, let them just be that and help them be that. Like there's a character last year in the pilot later on, the character's name is Olivia, and we shot an hour and a half of two cameras to try and get like one little tear to come out of her. And it was just like I was just at wit's end. And we got the scene to work. And this year she's crying all over the place. She's doing a great job. And we're getting performance out of people. It just you just have to keep working with them and keep helping them get to where they need to go because they want to go. They want to do their best, right?
I mean, if we could just drill down a little bit into what you said about, you know, you're casting these people and you're letting them be who they are. But I mean, when it comes to writing the story and coming up with conflict, I mean, are you relying on sort of classic, I guess, music archetypes? You know, I remember reading this article from Dave Grohl, you know, way back when, and he was obviously Nirvana, and he said that he always hated traveling because everyone else would get musician on their visas and he would get, you know, drummer. And he was kind of treated like a second class citizen, and he vowed that on his next band he would be the lead singer and play guitar because he was tired of being relegated to being a drummer. So do you rely on those kind of classic music archetypes?
So I think that's a good question on a couple of fronts. So yes, we do try and use the form, the medium to generate story. We also create our own fetish objects. So who gets to be lead singer would be traditional point of conflict for an episode. But we could also, and I'm just, you know, spitballing, say something like whoever could hit a perfect note or who had perfect pitch or could make a sound that no one had ever heard before could do something as a motivating force in a story. They're also, though, just in a way the setting to story, because that's activity. Activity is not story. Story is activity that makes you say, why the hell did the character do that? Now you have the beginnings of story. And a lot of writers confuse that. They just want interesting activity. You just start there. That just is your situation, right? This is, in essence, a situation comedy. There's some more drama than comedy, but the situation is a bunch of kids in this music academy. Well, then it's really about who loves who belongs, who doesn't belong, am I authentic, am I not authentic, do I matter, why don't they like me, why are they mean to me? All the things that we always, always deal with, but in that setting. And you can't confuse the two. Sometimes we do in the room. We go, oh, look at this activity. And go, well, what's going on? Nothing. Better be really interesting to hold our attention. You better have really great advancements the next time you come back to that story. You're going to be really bored. Whereas if you had something that inherently has tension, then you're interested. And then all that activity around it matters. Like we had a story where James, who sort of crossover, he's a dancer, a phenomenal dancer, he's also the drummer, had to win Riley back, do this that exercise where you have to bring like a chicken, a bag of grain, and a fox across the river in a boat, and they both can't be in there. And they acted it out, for real. Like one of them played the fox, and they made a river, and it's like a whole episode of these idiots trying to figure it out. And it was delightful, but there were other stories that were kind of ulcerating out of it and the fights between them, and we could see their characters, and it was really there so he could win Riley back. So all this extra energy, the activity was moot. But yes, this gives us fodder, right? And we talk all the time in the writing room about creating our own fetish object. What can we do that's slightly different than who's going to be lead singer? Although we'll do that trope. We'll do any convention that we need to. We'll mine anything. But yes,
because your actors, you know, you're giving them a lot of freedom to play and allowing them to improv lines. And do you get how much story do you get from them and just being around them all the time? versus how much story comes directly from the room?
I don't know. I think sometimes some of them will say, oh, this happened to me. I'm like, oh, that could be interesting. We could put that in there. Well, I don't think we're necessarily – did we get many stories from them this year? I don't think so. I think mostly just came out of the room, us making stuff up. How they interpret something we're finding interesting. We have a character, Jude, played by Deshaun Clark, who's a rapper. And our suspicions about who he was as a character are proving to be quite different from who he's giving us now. And it's glorious. Like, he is a delight. He's absolutely captivating, and we're pushing him in ways that we never thought we could. And he's going, too. Like, today we had this scene he had to do where he had to kind of tell a girl that the way they were dressed wasn't authentic. Like, they got all kind of dressed like a rocker chick with makeup and stuff like that, and it wasn't them. And I tried to get him to sort of convey this notion of, like, the old you was like, and the new you was like, which is sort of a judgment, but it isn't. And he had a lot of trouble getting it. But when he did, like when he got the comedy of it, which isn't natural to him necessarily, even though it is, it's not like a muscle he's gotten practiced much. When he got it, it was great. And we're pushing him now into this way. It's just this ease about him. It's so amazing. Like, we all want to write for him. And matter of fact, he's now going to have a relationship. He's going to fall in love with this other girl, and we were going to have her fall in love with this other boy. And it's like, no, this is the chemistry. So that came from them, mm-hmm. right? That's the room listening. I can't remember who it was who said that. Was it Amy who suggested it? Was it Laura? Laura, who was it? Amy? Who suggested the... It wasn't me. I was going this other way, and somehow out of the room came, let it be Jude and Ava that fall in love. And it was like, what? That? Oh, ooh, yes. Like, I had the decency to at least consider the room's pitch, right? It was great. And now the room is back troweling all these to cameras and these in the remaining episodes. How can we bolster up? Like, you know, let's add a wig to that one apostle. Like, we're changing the painting and making it richer. So in that sense, that's where the if you're listening to what the actor is giving you, like the way they move, what they can do, what their capability is, then you can start writing story for that too, right? And that's the job of a writer too. Like, anytime you see an actor on set that has trouble with dialogue, it's your fault. You wrote crap. Change it. They can't say it. Why? Because it's stupid. Change it. If it's good dialogue, anyone can remember it forever. Right? That's the rule of thumb. So when I see an actor having trouble, I'll go, we wrote you poopy stuff. Don't even bother. Let's find another way to say that, or let's throw that all out. That's no good. And that's what we do. As a result, we have less bad stuff to cut in post. Sorry.
No, it's fascinating how... I'd love you to just explain a little bit in more detail how these shows sort of came into existence, because, you know, like a typical tween show, you'd write a couple scripts and a Bible, everything is on the page until, you know, and then you go out looking for these characters you've created. You know, you've created these backstories and you know everything, and then you go to and try to find actors who fit into what you have in your head.
So I wrote after I cast, right? Rather than writing a pilot and then try and find some actor to do that, I just auditioned people that I liked. I said, ooh, you're good looking and you're a good singer. You're Shane, right? Shane is this great looking guy, and he's turning out to be such a great actor. He's so diligent. He was the lead in the thing. I like you. Let's figure out how you fit. And then there's this other character, Alex, and then we go, oh, they're going to be, they love each other like they're brothers. They're the best friends, and they've known each other for a long time. And then we start adding, he's kind of messed up, the one character, because his energy is a little more dour and serious. Well, why? Well, his mom died, and he's messed up from that, right? And then we added more stuff. Like, this year we find out his mom killed herself
he's dealing with that. And then there's another character who's, we're going to do a character, the girl Jenny, the little girl with the red hair. We're going to make her manic depressive. And John saves her because he recognizes that in her. Like, all this is just kind of coming out of seeing, well, who's Jenny? Like, there's this kind of serious kind of energy to her, and what can we play out of that energy? You know, listening to what, like, we have the new show, The Next Step 4, we're bringing in a bunch of new characters in. You see the tapes, like yesterday the actors were looking at the audition, or the writers looked at the audition tapes, and they were already getting immediate ideas about what we can do, just based on them, not on this idea of our words or our stories. Like, let them inform the process.
I mean, that's a very interesting process, very different than most shows. So do you feel like you've just kind of earned that comfort level with your network and your production company, you know, Family Channel and Temple Street, that they allow you to, because, you know, a lot of times they want to see something on the page and they want to make sure it's all there before they hand over any money. And so do you feel like you've earned that kind of comfort level to say, hey, let me go and play?
Yeah, no. I think I don't make it easy. I'm not an easy EP to work with. I think I make it hard on them. I wish I could make it easier, but I'm so maniacally in defense of what I think the show should be. I don't like everyone. I'm like, I'm always sort of like just suspicious and fiercely defensive of that process. So I guess on some level, yeah, they entrusted me, like the pilot for this was well over $1 million. And I just wrote, I didn't do a Bible. I wrote a massive script that was an hour.
And it was like two
pilots,
half parts?
A 2.5 hour, and there was only budget for a half. And I said, well, we could shoot that in an extra half day. And I kind of worked my way to shooting over 6 days, and I got an hour out of it because I knew it needed an hour. And I couldn't tell the story in a half an hour. And the pilot turned out great. Like, it was the highest testing pilot that the testing company had ever seen. Not to blow smoke up my bum, but it was. Like, kids went crazy, and it's gone around the world, and everyone responded in a really positive way. Well, I had I fiercely honored what I thought it should be. And I, like, that theme song was written by one of the writers. Amy Cole is in a band called Rural Alberta Advantage. She couldn't be here because she went to the ball game instead. But we're going to meet after for drinks with the other writers. And she wrote that theme song. I said, I hate the song that's there. You're in a band. You write something. And she did. And then she brought it to me. And I said, well, I don't like that lyric. That seems stupid. What about? And she changed it. And then, oh, this sounds good. And then she came up with the whole, I don't even get involved in the music side. Like, that's so far beyond my small brain musically, right? She figured that stuff out. Now it's a really catchy song. And it engendered the name of the series. Lost and Found. We are the lost. We are the, right? Like, all this is just ulcerating out of just letting the reality do what it needs to do. And that takes trust that you know what you're doing. You have to believe in yourself. And you could still be wrong. That's okay.
And you said that you don't really have any affinity for writing music and performing music.
Nor dance.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
For that matter. No, not at all. And my defense is that it gives me an objectivity to the process. But no, like, most of the songs, when they're put on the floor, I've never heard them before. But even on the ride here, we were talking about a song that I just shot. And they were saying, well, that song used to be, and I was like, was that song? He said, no, we're talking about a completely different song. I had no idea what anyone was talking about. Like, I don't know lyrics to any songs. I can't remember them. It's not part, but it's not germane. I know what a good song is. I think we all know what a good song is. And that's the other thing, like the music department we have, there's these brilliant people up in this room that gets really hot. It's like the Brill Building. They just keep spitting out hits. We're doing 80 songs. They're all this good. And I don't know what they're doing in there, but I had the good sense to hire good people. Marco De Felice runs that department. You guys are genius. Do your thing, sir. And he does.
And now you're in charge of a live tour and releasing 80 songs. And I noticed Temple Street releasing. Is that like a sort of offshoot of this?
Well, that song, like, so that song was written for Next Step season 3, and my daughter Francesca sang it, and then when we were out in the desert, I wanted to shoot a video of it. So that's, you know, like made on iPhone 6. That was like 1 hour in Joshua Tree. And all those shots where you see her looking like Dewar and Sirius is like, because she's like fed up. She was like, it's too hot, Dad. I don't want to do this anymore. I said, I need one more. I just need a... I just, like me, you know, pimping my daughter out to sing in the desert. This is sort of horrendous. But I wanted to do it. And I also, like, I edited that on Avid. Like, normally there's editors, and I wanted to sort of experience that process. But that was just a temple. So, yeah, so on the thing, it's on YouTube. I just did it. I just put it up there.
But when you go to a tour with these 80 songs, they're going to be released on, like, iTunes and, like, have a...
Well, again, beyond me, I just have to worry about making the show and some of the ancillary material around it. I don't have to worry about that. It will take care of itself. Or not. I can't control it.
Well, maybe we could throw, in our last sort of 15 minutes, throw the floor open to any questions that anyone might have.
Do we give them a mic?
Do you want to pick?
Sir, hi.
Could you just wait? Grab
oh,
the mic?
Look, there's a microphone.
Just for the podcast, because we're recording it.
Hi, my name's Brian. I'm a big fan of the Kids in the Hall. Could you follow up with that story about how you got fired and tell us some more juicy details?
Why?
Because I think it's a cool story.
It's not a cool story. I'll tell you an even cooler story. How's this?
Okay.
All right. You guys want to know? I told the story earlier today. Interestingly enough, do you guys want to know where the squishy head guy came from?
Yes.
Would that be better?
Yeah.
All right. Then don't bug me about that other stuff. Back in the 1940s, in England, there was a scoutmaster, and he went to Harry Secombe's house, who was one of the goons, and he said to Harry, "Hello, I'm interested in getting a donation for my scout troop." And Harry Secombe, the other one of the goons being Peter Sellers, said, "Oh, I can't help you, but Peter Sellers might. He's a big fan of scouts." And he wasn't. He just wanted Peter to hear that voice. So he sent him over to Peter Sellers. And Peter Sellers heard the voice. And out of that, he created a character called Blue Bottle in The Goons. Blue Bottle narrated his own stage directions when he was on the radio show in the 1950s, right? And he was sort of, "Hello, everyone. He walks to the center of the audience, bows gracefully, and looks to the skies." It was sort of that character, right? So I'm with the Kids in the Hall back then in Calgary called The Audience, and I'm a massive fan of The Goons. I listen to all these radio shows, and I develop a character called Cecil Iguana.
And the Cecil Iguana, he sort of talked like this. He was more like this.
We had this sort of iguana kind of throat thing. And Mark developed Eddie Iguana, his brother, and we would do sketches.
And Eddie Iguana was much more like this with the voice. Much more like this.
And then one day he called me up. He's like, "I got this new character. It's like, it's this crushy head guy." I don't know what the hell he was talking about at the time, but it's sort of like Eddie Iguana. I said, "Well, do it."
And that is where the crushy head guy came from,
right? So out of a scoutmaster in 1940s war-ravaged England comes the crushy head guy. All of them evolutionarily distinct and unique and glorious.
You never know where your inspiration is going to come from.
Is that better?
Huh? Another question?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, thanks. Hi. For starters, congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, your story and creating the Next Step, really, it's a Canadian success story that is mind-blowing. Michael and Sarah, when they are traveling around representing Family Channel, or what was formerly known as Family Channel, they talk about your show and the tours, and basically if you ask them what they're looking for, it's more Frank Van Keeken. So that is spectacular.
You should see the notes I get from them, though. It's a little bit less Frank Van Keeken. No, he did have the good sense. Like, he saw the pilot, because I shot the pilot in about 14 hours. a day and a quarter. I edited it by myself with my editor, Jay Prichidney, a brilliant editor. And he just cut it. And I would go in and do notes. And I finished it. Like, I didn't let anyone see it. And then Temple saw it and they said, no notes. And we showed it to the network. And a month later, they ordered 26 episodes. So I thought of it driving in April and shot it in July, August, and cut in September and picked up in October. Because of the quality of the show and the support, and again having these insanely good dancers, and maybe there was need on the network for a show like that, but it was a big risk for them. There was reticence, but Michael, you know, to his credit, said, "Yeah, let's go this way."
It's I do have a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, it's amazing. They talk about it basically as a way to get away from their Disney shows because they wanted something to distinguish themselves from, you know, the multicam, brightly lit sitcom. Certainly you've created something amazing. My question is about the tone. And in terms of where you're aiming with the scripts, one thing that is very apparent in the show is it is very overt. Characters will say consistently what they're thinking. I like you. I'm nervous. In one case, a character in tonight's episode fell down. And then he said in the confessional, I'm dizzy, or I was dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious in terms of where you're aiming, because of course writers often try not to have the characters say what is, you know, specifically on their minds, or you try to layer it. Is it the network? Is it your vision? Or is it the audience themselves that is guiding this particular place where you put these scripts with not only, of course, the action that we see, but also the confessionals?
A roundabout answer might be, and I talk about this in the writing room, let everyone know everything right away. Let everyone be as smart as possible right away. What then? And that advances story. Because a lot of storytelling is to delay the knowledge of something from someone for as long as possible. And it gets just boring. Well, what happens if you just reveal that right away? What now? Well, then you have to keep advancing the story, making for a richer story. And I also think it's, you know, I am trying in a bizarre way to deal with more archetypal, deep-seated story than is sort of currently visually there. The discussions in the room are about Jungian psychology and Zen and subterranean energies, and we attack character from there, but it's not overtly manifested in those episodes other than it resonates its way through. So a three-year-old understands this concept of I will die. Right? Well, then you can talk about it. Not in a way that is inappropriate, but in a way that a three-year-old can get. But they get it. A six-year-old gets stuff, an eight-year-old, a 10-year-old. So it's really just about how do you show, like, a kiss. Well, a kiss means love, to be loved, to have attraction. Francesca's seven is like, you should see the kissing that's going on Full House, like she's watching all the Full Houses, right? So what are you talking about? And what's it, PJ Tanner? Was kissing this boy, and I was like, holy, I can't hold my kisses that long on Family. This was done in 87. So there's like, you know, so we shorten the kiss. Like Family will say, the kiss is too long. And we keep taking, like, you know, little cuts until the kiss is okay. But it's that we're talking about that kiss that really the kids care about. How long it is, we can deal with. I don't know if that answers the question.
I got to talk to my three-year-olds tonight about death. I think I picked that up about it.
Well, they do. I remember Francesca asking me, she said, Daddy, are you going to die? Because some chicken had died on our farm. And I said, yeah. And then there was like this sort of, and then she said, am I going to die? And I said, yeah, but it's going to be a long time from now. You don't need to worry about it. But it existentially ravages me most of my waking moments, right? Like it drives me to not waste time, not what, not this, not like it's there. They're thinking about it. They're thinking about being loved. I mean, you know, she's talking about some cute boy on the soccer field on Saturday of last week. you know? He's so cute. She's seven, you know? She's thinking about these things. Now, obviously, you know, we don't go to strip clubs together. Save that for my older children. We have discussion, like the how you show that storytelling is very different. It's appropriate for a seven-year-old.
I think there were two more questions at the three more, maybe four.
Yeah, I'm happy. I drove all the way out here to do this, so I could stay.
just a question about starting out. How important do you think it is as a young comic writer or writer of any type for TV to go to the United States, like to make that journey to New York or Los Angeles? Would you say that that's like absolutely necessary, or there's a change in climate in Canada where we can stay here and build on what's going on at home?
I think one of the good things about Canada is that it's a more, you got to be, you know, I wrote sketch and little radio play stuff and sitcoms and stand-up and improv. And so it developed a really wide skill set. Whereas when you go to the States, you tend to be sort of a specialist, right? I'm a joke guy. I punch up features. Like, it's so narrowly defined. And I think it's good to develop a wide set of skills, even if it's how to make a good cappuccino in a Starbucks. I mean, there is some story value to that, right? Everything will be grist for the mill. So you need to just develop as much of that as possible. And then the journey to the States might be easier in that you will be more valuable to them. I think the States, there's much more noise and many more people, but the desire to value talent is greater there. I think they'll promote faster. They want to find the next big thing. That's sort of a mixed answer. So it depends what you want. Like, if you want world global domination in a sitcom, very hard to do from here. I think you should go to the States.
There's a quote from Eric McCormick that was really great about that he said that he was performing in Canada and then went down and obviously blew up on Will and Grace. And he said, you know, I just got to the point in my career where I wanted, if my tree was falling, I wanted someone to hear it. And I think sometimes you get to that point in this country where you think, is anyone hearing my tree? And, you know, he wanted to go and get a global audience.
I don't know if that answered the question.
No, it did. Thank you.
Yeah. Like, sometimes it's okay to go and not make it. That was in my head when I went, right? But then I at least could say in my life, when I was working in that Starbucks, I went to L.A., crapped out, but I went, rather than I never went.
Can you talk a bit about the difference between pitching and developing in Canada versus the States? Like, what did you find? How were your ideas met and developed differently?
I think it's basically the same. I mean, I've tried to short circuit the development process in that I've tried to make it so I don't have to spend 2 years in development. So the next step was a half an hour, was it whatever, a 20-minute pilot that was a full pilot that I got from inception to ordering, you know, 5-6 months. But I purposely tried to control that by shooting a pilot, because if all you have is a script, then it's that development process. And in the States, it's pretty fast. Like, they're buying pilots in the next few weeks, they're going to start, and you hand your first draft in before Thanksgiving and your second draft by Christmas, and you might do a little polish, and you'll find out if you're picked up by February, and you'll shoot it by May, and you're on the air pretty quickly thereafter. That's every season there. Well, here it could be years. So there's a time delay, but other than that, I mean, you go in and you're a salesman. You're trying to sell this notion, right, this thing that you love. It's the same. I mean, I pitched the same there as here. So it's sort of the same.
Is there any more?
Yes. Hey, first, thanks for doing this. As a, you know, fresh writer, this kind of stuff's invaluable. So thank you for coming out. The question is, what's the biggest struggle writing a teen or tween show that you wouldn't have writing a show for adults?
There's no difference.
School breaks, maybe? Tutors?
Yeah, you might have kids on an adult show. I mean, you know, occasionally if your lead is under 16, it can be a pain. But I have more ensemble-y kind of cast, so it's not really an issue. Sometimes I got to wait 20 minutes for someone to finish their school for the day. There's no difference. I mean, I think adult television has bigger budgets, by and large. But then you're making smaller numbers of episodes. Like, I'm on season 4 of The Next Step, and I'll have done 140 episodes. That's more exciting to me than I'm at 40, right? I'd be at 40 maybe.
So no, I don't.
There's no difference.
Thanks.
I had a question. Did you block shoot all the seasons? Do you block shoot all the seasons? That's the first question. And the second question is, what happened to Michelle and Emily and Eldon? Man, that was epic. I thought it was going to go on forever. Is it coming back? Like, what's going on?
Well, I can't reveal too much.
Oh, come on.
I know...
A little hint.
Someone's phone is ringing. Is that me?
Oh, that's a nice distraction. Nice try.
No. So you haven't seen all of season 3 because Eldon is now involved. He's trying to go with Talia.
I know.
There's the back half of that. So what happened to Michelle?
Yeah. Dude, that was like legendary. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's all right.
I think the problem was that ultimately there wasn't the kind of chemistry that I had with Jiley. Mm-hmm. And I got to celebrate that stuff. So I'll answer this mm-hmm. way. There is a Michalax. Would that be the new ship? What's the new ship? How would I say that? What would be the ship? What? Mish? No. Alex and...
What?
What? Oh, it's John, right. It's Michonne. There is Michonne coming.
Okay. Good to know.
There is Michonne coming.
Okay. All right.
And you will be delighted.
Okay.
I think that will really be great. And you had a second question?
Although, do you block shoot the entire season?
Well... We try to shoot chronologically, but we'll block if there's like 2 or 3 episodes and we're in the music room, we'll try and bang those out.
Okay.
But I prefer to shoot chronologically if we can.
Good for you.
I guess it helps your actors,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
With the improv?
Yes. It's hard. And as they get more sophisticated in season 2, season 3, it's like, what am I? Am I sad? Am I angry? Okay, good. Boom. And they can do it a little more easily.
Was there any other questions before we wrap?
Thanks. I just had a question about theme, because you had a theme for Next Step and a different theme for the music one. Can you just talk about at what point in the process you come up with...
The earliest. It's the fundamentally most important aspect of writing a show that has some kind of resonance, some kind of homogeneity, some kind of consistency. And I, my little rule of thumb is, if you can't sing a theme song to your show... You have no hope of a hit. And any great show has a great theme song that completely, even if you're talking MASH, right? Suicide is Painless, Cheers, A Place Where Everyone Knows My Name, You're Not the Boss of Me Now, You're Not the Boss of Me Now, It Just So, Here's a Story of a Lovely Lady. You know the show. It's thematically consistent and correct. Say again?
Even Game of Thrones, you feel like that song existed before the show even did.
Yeah, it is somehow emblematic of what is there. I mean, I'm being apocryphal and a little bit, hyperbolic, but you need that. You have no show. You just have a bunch of people hopping around doing stuff that will live or die by how interesting you are that week. Rather than, like, there's so many things here that don't make sense to anyone that doesn't know the next step that resonate with what's going on with Chloe and, you know, whatever, all the stuff with Tally, and it all makes sense to the kids watching because thematically it's sort of consistent. So it's the most important thing.
And how do you know when you've kind of settled on the right theme for the show?
It's what you want to do as a writer, right? If you want to write about there is no hope or there is hope or there might be hope, well, there's 3 different shows. They could all be about guys in a firehouse putting out fires, right? Same. It's just how you want to approach it. That's where you need to think about what you want to write about. I personally, I'm into hope. I want the world to be better. I think it's hard fought. It's not easy, but ultimately I think hope's the most important thing.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks so much for coming out, Frank.
Thank you.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for listening to Writers Talking TV, featuring Frank Van Keeken, showrunner of The Next Step and Lost and Found Music Studios. Let us know what you think by emailing us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. That's writerstalkingtv, all one word, @gmail.com. If you enjoyed the podcast, please log on to iTunes and share your positive feedback, which helps us to increase its profile. Writers Talking TV is presented by the Writers Guild of Canada, and today's event was held at the TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto. The show's technical producer is Philip Vukovic. I'm Nicole Demers. Thanks so much for listening.